Dr. Sherwin Nuland's writings about medicine display a literary gift and a lifetime of training. He's a surgeon who teaches medicine at Yale. His book, How We Die, won the National Book Award. His latest book, Lost in America, is a memoir in which inevitably Sherwin Nuland sees his own life through the lens of medicine. The book is mostly about his family and Nuland's difficult relationship with his father, Meyer. Meyer was a man of fractured speech, unkempt appearance, a hair-trigger temper, and a faltering step. Lost in America is subtitled A Journey with My Father, and in that journey, the old man burdened young Sherwin Nuland, both figuratively and literally.
He walks with me through every day of my life in that unsteady, faltering gait that so embarrassed me when I was a boy. Always, he's holding fast to the upper part of my right arm. Now and then, the uncertain grip of his hand slips just a bit, and he grabs more deeply for security onto the cloth of my sleeve and the skin beneath. It is pinched between his fingertips as though in the jaws of a clamp, and I wince with pain. As his hold tightens, I tell him that he's hurting me. He's offended by that, and he lets me know it in grumbling Yiddish.
A boy's relationship with his father, in the sugar-coated version, is something sweet. It involves vital lessons, enduring love. This is a story about, use the word there, embarrassed. It's about shame, something deeper than embarrassment.
Well, that's certainly so. All through my life, from my earliest recollection, there were two emotions that would pour forth in me with a mere thought of my father. One was fear, in fact, which lessened naturally as the years went by, but shame was a constant.
Shame about the way that he looked?
It was shame about everything. I think it was shame primarily because he was so different from any adult male that I saw near me, even in an area that was filled with immigrants, whether they were Irish, Italian, or Jewish. There were no people like my father. There were no people who walked the way he did. There were no people who mangled the English language in the particular way that he did. His was a unique accent. It wasn't just a Yiddish accent. It was inflected with the mannerisms of the Italian garment workers that he was with in the shops where he toiled all those years. So that in itself was unique. He was, because of the physical disabilities that he had, bent over, uncertain of his gait. And so whether it was simply the way he looked or the way he sounded or the way he conversed with people in that very unsophisticated, unwise way of his, that I would emotionally look the other way, always when I was with him.
You describe a moment in your adolescence, which, as you say, to this day you remember very vividly, although you can't recall what provoked it, when your father suddenly erupts in a terrible rage at you.
Yes. It was, in a certain way, an emotional turning point for me, an inner emotional turning point. The only thing I remember about what it was that provoked it was that I had said something that he felt demeaned him in some way. And the explosion was immediate, unexpected, and seemingly endless. It must have gone on for 5 minutes of yelling and shouting and deprecating me as he had probably felt he was deprecated. And he chased me into the other room where I had run to escape from and just flung myself on the couch and wails of tears, and he stood over me, shouting, and then all of a sudden, it stopped.
Somewhere mixed up in your father's rages were also pains that he felt, pains in his legs that he felt.
Well, later on, when I found out what his underlying disease was, I came to understand what these were. They were called lightning pains. That was what our family doctor, who was also our cousin, called them. They were sudden, severe, either burning or knife-like pains in his shins that would start from the level of the ankle and just go right up to his knees. And they were so severe that he would grimace with pain and grasp onto his leg if he was sitting down or if he was standing. He had to seek the nearest opportunity to sit or lie down. And they would last like lightning, just momentarily. And he would always be embarrassed by them and always look up at me with this small smile of embarrassment. And, of course, later on I found out that those were part of the disease process itself. In fact, it was one of the ways that I identified the disease by reading about it in one of my medical school textbooks and identifying those lightning pains.
That moment when you're in medical school, which you liken to, I guess, the steer in the slaughterhouse when it's clubbed between the eyes so that it can be it can be killed at that moment. So stunning was this to you. You're reading about the symptoms of someone of unsteady gait, of bladder problems and infections, of shooting pains in the legs. And this man whom you'd felt so such shame for, suddenly you understand, you come to an understanding of what's wrong with him.
Well, imagine the scene. It was very late at night, about 11 or so. It was cold in the dorm. I was sitting on my bed trying to read this abstruse physiology book that I couldn't have cared less about, but I had to get through the neurological part of it because there were some things I had to know for the next day. And I'm reading in this numbed way, and all of a sudden I realize that I'm reading about my father. And I keep reading. Everything is described that fits him as though he were the person they were talking about. So I looked back because I had not seen the section heading, and it said something about tabes dorsalis. I had no notion of what tabes dorsalis was. So I went back to the major heading, and there it was. Syphilis, the very first sentence. And that was indeed, as I describe it in the book, like being hit with a mallet right smack in the middle of my forehead. All of those years of making assumptions that this was some unique thing that had only affected my father, and that so much of it was a situation that he was taking advantage of, and although I didn't know the word psychosomatic at that time, that it was psychosomatic, much of it, and bingo, there it is. And the sudden realization at first enraged me, because, of course, one associates syphilis with the worst sort of people. And then things began to come into perspective in the succeeding hours. And yes, I did begin to understand my father. And I did begin to understand that these were situations that were so far beyond his control, that everything that I had been ashamed of and everything that I'd been castigating him for were matters over which he really had very little control.
The doctor was able to treat him for a long time and just tell him, well, you're sick, but not say you have syphilis.
That's right. In fact, what is remarkable to me is that there's no evidence that my father ever asked whether he had a disease with a name. He just seemed to assume that whatever the process was, it was relentless and it would keep on progressing and wouldn't change, but that there would be no treatment beyond that short course of penicillin.
You begin this story with the tale of your own hospitalization some years ago for depression.
Yes.
You were hospitalized for depression, quite serious stuff, and not too far from having had a lobotomy at one point.
That's right. I had become seized not just with the depths of this depression, but with a kind of an obsessional thinking, and I was focusing on ritualistic ideas. I was really compelled to think about religion all the time and coincidences and numbers, and I couldn't get it out of my head no matter how much I struggled with it. And all sorts of medications had been tried. Clearly, ordinary psychotherapy wasn't working. And this was toward the end of the time when lobotomy was still being occasionally used. And I was at this large private psychiatric facility where there were some very distinguished people running the place. And they had a conference and they said, look, the only thing that we can do with this man is to separate his frontal lobes from the rest of his brain and get those ideations out. And they were about to do that. And the young psychiatrist in training, only in his second year of training, as a matter of fact, after internship, just dug in his heels, and he said, no, you're not going to do that. I'm just convinced that all of this is based on depression and depression alone. Mm-hmm. And what he needs is electroshock therapy. And at first, it didn't work, and it took a total of 20 electroshock treatments before things were completely changed.
What connection do you make between depression and your father and your upbringing and your relationship with your father? Or do you make any connection at all?
Oh, I make every possible connection. As far back as I have been able to determine in my family, there has been no history of depression except in the usual sense of existential depression just due to the circumstances of their lives. And I must tell you that when I was in the depths of depression, I was my father. I walked like my father. I was bent over like him. My speech was hesitant like his. My self-image of being a defeated and very sick person, unable to cope with the realities of life, was exactly like the way I had seen him as a child and as a young man in general. I was essentially repeating my image of him and creating it within myself.
I was just wondering if you could read to us from the afterword to Lost in America.
Yes, I can certainly do that.
And perhaps the paragraph that begins, I will never know the cost of being Meyer's son.
I will never know the cost of being Meyer's son. When midway in life's circuitous journey I found myself entrapped within those dark, entangled woods, I should not have blamed him for my loss of direction. My father was without a compass, and he, too, had missed his path. The choices I had made and the directions I had taken to lead me into the morass were mine alone. The blundering attempts to loose myself from the thickets were also mine. But unlike him, I did, at last, find my way out. Even my bad choices were not enough to prevent my ultimate choice, which was to resume the voyage and make it in peace.
Sherwin Newland, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Sherwin Newland, who is the author of Lost in America, A Journey with My Father,